You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Franklin Crawford. Franklin, it's good to have you here.
Thank you. Good to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
So, Franklin, the way the show begins is with a huge question. Who are you? What do we need to know to start this conversation?
If I knew that, I wouldn't have to be here anymore. I could move on. I could go into a cave and stare at a wall. But I'm still finding out who I am. Mm-hmm. So,
at this moment, where do we start?
I'm a white male American born on June 2nd, 1958, at Southside Hospital in Bayshore, Long Island. But some tragic things happened and some very good things happened. I moved to Ithaca to go to school in, 76. And that was a bit of luck in itself because it was the only place I applied to and we were very poor. And it was a financial aid program for minorities. So my family's income was so bad.
Right.
So I qualified on that loan for this program. And I think at that point, they were just starting to try to open up the educational opportunity program to consider people's
income
yes. And family.
And you came to Ithaca College, or?
Yeah, my sister, who lives here, went back here a long time ago, went to Ithaca College, Roberta Crawford. She's the co-founder of the Finger Lakes Chamber Ensemble. So she went to the music school here, and I had played bass off and on in high school, and then it got to be about my sophomore year, and I realized I was flunking out for a variety of reasons, and I had to do something. And so I picked the bass up again, and there was a dearth of bass players, and played in the high school orchestra, learned how to play a little bit, and took a lesson from the teacher up here, Henry Newbert, one summer, and he wasn't so impressed. And I came back to visit my sister the following summer and followed his advice and practiced a lot, and he was impressed. And he said, why don't you consider, now at this time, Ithaca College did not have the quality of the studio that Nicholas Walker has built up there. And I would never have gotten in, but they needed bass players. And so there was luck right there. And so I got into IC, but, you know, there were some other issues, and I had to leave in my second semester I took a leave of absence for quite a while. And then that's how I really got into the insides of Ithaca, starting as a dishwasher down at the now long defunct Old Port Harbor, where Corks and Moore was. And, I walked right into the middle of it, because all those folks were going to be long-term Ithacans, and I still have associations and friends from that. And I went from there, and then I worked at Cabbage Town Cafe, which is some people remember, not everybody.
Oh, yeah.
And that was another whole set of people that I got to know, and they're still around, a lot of them, and we're friends to this day. So there's luck right there. Mm-hmm. You know, you run into two different groups of people that are really the younger core of Ithaca. A lot of them were musicians, and very good musicians, and I was friends with them, and I was playing a lot of piano then. I taught myself some piano, and I wasn't really crazy about the bass, let's put it this way.
Uh-huh.
It didn't do it for me.
Right.
And I had ambitions as a composer, let's say. But I was so far behind by the time I started. Music was really hieroglyphics to me, and I had a hard enough time reading it, never mind trying to write the complex stuff I heard in my head, which was too bad. But I did get a few lessons with Carol Holzer, who's is a Pulitzer Prize winning composer who taught at IC. And, he encouraged me after he saw my fumblings, but that didn't take. He was right. I was too far behind in some ways. And the technology hadn't come along yet where I could, sort of cut some corners.
Couldn't play it into the instrument and then it printed it out for you.
Something like that. Yeah. I had dreams of something like that back then. But, as it turned out, I went back to IC maybe 4 years later, 1980-81. I was working at the Chariot, and then, which was the first of the two restaurants that Mark Keelman and his partner ran. Then they opened the Nines.
Nines, yeah.
So that was on Eddy Street, just up from where Cabbage Town was, and I was a bartender and a pizza maker and whatnot, and then I went down to the West End, where they were trying to change over the West End Saloon, which had been the Salty Dog, mm-hmm. and the new owner was trying to turn it into a family-style bar restaurant. The old crowd was just so resentful and angry about that. They would always come in and try to spoil any night that they could. And that was their place. They were getting dislodged. And there were some rough nights there, encounters with them. Well, look, guys, you gotta quiet down. Who are you? I was like, wow, I can't do this. I mean, Ronald Reagan's in office, and how much longer are they gonna let me hang before I can come back and go to school again, if I can even get back in?
Sure.
And I went and visited them, and the folks at the program said, if you're looking for a warm place to stay for the winter, Franklin, don't bother. But if you're serious about coming back, talk to your bass teacher, show him what you got, we'll discuss it. And I was allowed to come back, which is just a beautiful thing, because I know people that don't have their college degrees, and that's not good these days. And I took a bunch of writing courses, and I was redirected toward writing, which was something I had been doing, but I was dyslexic early on, and I had a lot of trouble writing anything. My sister was appalled at these papers I would turn in, and writing became the thing. It's easier to carry a pencil than a bass, and eventually I became a reporter at the Ithaca Journal. On my 30th birthday in 1988, I was hired after being homeless for a little while. So. That's how that happened, and I was there for 10 years. Went up to Cornell, and I worked there for 10 years. And I left in 2008 to do my own thing, and I've been kind of doing that ever since.
Interesting. We have some parallels. I was a quota kid from a subsistence farm in Northwest Missouri on scholarship at Cornell. So I grew up in rural poverty. And I did well my first semester because I took really small courses, but I wasn't prepared for Cornell, and ended up taking a leave of absence halfway through my fifth semester when I was failing everything. Worked construction locally, got to know some of the construction workers, and got to know the people coming out of the family, the Yegod families that were kind of to reintegrate into society, and worked with some of them on some projects, and the first gut rehab that Mac Travis ever did on the corner of Seneca and Eddy Street, that was a project I helped work on. I was able to go back and finish after 9 months. But I would say it probably has taken me a lot of years to find my feet.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, you brought some music with you. What would you like to play first?
Well, I have this little tune of mine I brought that's sort of an example of one type of music I do. I was initially known to be a songwriter, and that's what I did back when I was in those years of Leaves of Absence. There's a new book. I got in close with the local musicians here, who some of them were the Zobo Fun Band crew.
I remember.
A lot of people don't know who they are, but
I don't know who they are.
Most of them went on
and
went on to fairly good careers. Very tragically and sadly, Jeremy Werbin, the lead singer, that died young from complications with diabetes. And then there was another band with Danny Spears, kind of the headman of that. It was called the Peabody Band, with Chris Broadwell and Jill Gannon and Mark Sammo and Eric or Aceto, or Harry Aceto. So I ran into all those folks, and Dave Arnay and Jill Gannon lived together in the Commons and would let me come over and play piano there, because back in those days, I was just desperate to get to a piano. It was the only way I could get through a day, because we can come around to that. I had developed a very serious problem, and it was killing me early. So these folks not only gave me space and encouraged me, they helped save my life.
Right. So this is a composition from that time?
No, this is probably maybe 6-7 years ago that I started playing again. And this is a little bit of an idea that I had, and then I went ahead and just improvised on it.
Okay.
But, you know, it's rough. It's a rough demo. You know, I record on a little digital recorder in my study. There's, you'll hear the piano chair squeaking. You might hear a cat.
Here we go.
That's all part of the experience.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Franklin Crawford. So, Franklin, what were some things you had to learn about life in order to be able to live the life that you value now? What did you have to go through?
That there's a huge gap between intention and reality.
I can sympathize with that one.
As a bit of a dreamer, and I was always surprised at how hard things were when I really tried to do them. And some of that was part of my, disorders. Some of that was just I wasn't well educated. I had not done well in school. I didn't pay a lot of attention. I was partying. My parents were falling apart at the seams. My brother was killed in Vietnam in 1971, and my folks couldn't pull it back together right. after that. So I was kind of caretaker at an early age, like around 14. And one of the unfortunate things about that was, you know, one of the ways I connected and bonded with my parents was to drink with them mm-hmm. separately. But
to drink too.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was sort of acceptable back then, you know, but you know, every once in a while they'd catch themselves and realize I was 14. By 15, I was messing around with drugs and I got picked up by the cops for something. And that was a harrowing afternoon because I was on some very heavy hallucinogens and I didn't know what good cop, bad cop was. Mm-hmm. And I thought, so I really screwed my head up.
So you got played.
Yeah, but they didn't realize I was, you know, they didn't believe I was 15. I had been on a like 12, 14 hour dishwashing shift the night before and had made my connection and was off to the beach to listen to the Mets play the Cardinals in the World Series, and I didn't make it. It was a little interruption. So that was harrowing. So I come from, you know, I was front loaded with a lot of heavy stuff, let's say. I was 12 when my brother was killed. I was told pretty much from the get-go, you know, you're the man of the house, you're the... My brother was like 8.5, 9 years older than me, so, you know, take care of your mother, you know, look out for your father. And I kind of took that to heart, that was my job.
Right. And your sister was between the two of you?
She, that fall, yeah, my sister's like 4.5 years older. And so that fall, he was killed in February of 71, and that fall she went to school. So I was with the folks.
You were it?
Yeah. And it was a haunting time.
Yeah. What do you know that you wish you didn't have to know and from that time?
That you can... give as much of yourself to something, to people who are on their own trajectory, and you can give them all the love and all the care that you have inside yourself. You can fight with them, love them dearly, and life will take its course with them as it will, according to the laws of nature, and they both wound up in psychiatric hospitals, and that was a sense of failure in a way for me that I had not been able to keep them from going collapsing completely. But we got evicted from our house. So.
And how old were you when they were hospitalized?
18.
17. So just before
17. Well, they were some hospitalizations for my mother for alcohol seizures. But really, long-term hospitalization for my father is also jail and prison. I was 16, 17, 18. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, I came up here with a lot of stuff, a lot of baggage, mm-hmm. and I thought I kind of escaped it.
And you ran away from it?
Well, no, I couldn't go back. There was no place to go back.
Nothing to go back to, sure.
Well, we were evicted, and they were from Pillager Post. And there was really no there. And Ithaca was my home.
Right.
And it's pretty much been that for 40 some odd years.
Right. So in the second semester, you took a leave?
Yeah.
And was that by your choice or by their asking you to leave?
No. When I went home for my Christmas break, everything collapsed, had collapsed. It was collapsing, I saw it around Thanksgiving. And it's a long history, so a lot to unpack. But we lived in a house in the back of two streets behind buildings that were built by my great-grandfather on my mother's side. These were going to be, at some point, mortgaged by my mother and father and become part of their life. And but my grandmother got cancer, and she freaked out about the changes in the neighborhood. Things were were changing a lot. And she sold out to a slumlord. And that was the beginning of a different phase. I wouldn't say the beginning of the end of the neighborhood. It was the beginning of the end of a different phase of that neighborhood.
Right. It was also the beginning of the end of your access to wealth.
Property, wealth, whatever. For my father. I'm thinking from my father's point of view, because I really didn't understand all of that and what that meant and how bitter it made him to wind up renting a house behind the houses he was to have. He and my mother were to have mortgaged, and he was a master carpenter. He did a 6-year apprenticeship on the GI Bill. He was very good at what he did. So there's a history there. But in the 76, 77, my father had pretty much lost his mind. And can explain the details of it are really hard to get into, but there was a fire in his shop. Fire department came, police arrived. There were charges against him. He was wandering around in his infantry trench coat with his helmet. He had suffered terribly in the Ardennes offensive. He was with the 78th Infantry Division, which was responsible for moving out of the upper salient of that and taking out the Schwamenau Dam, because the Germans were going to blow that and flood the Ruhr Valley, so Patton couldn't bring his army in. So he experienced about 126 straight days of constant...
high-intensity combat.
Yeah. And it was always march on, march on, march. There was no rest.
Right.
And so he didn't come back well.
Right.
And, catch me back and loop me back to where I was in that story. But anyway, so things were falling apart. I had a sweetheart then in high school. I was at her house. These were folks that were on the other side of town. And father was a lawyer, and they were well-to-do. And my mom called me several times and said, there's trouble here. And I had gotten burned out on it. I was like, there's always trouble there, Mom. She's like, no, this is real trouble. This is... I regret that I just didn't want to deal with it.
Right.
And I came home kind of late that night, and indeed his shop was gutted. He was off to Riverhead County Jail, partly a psychiatric arrest, and my mother was horrible coughing, and just she had had these open wounds on her legs. And I got her to the clinic the next day, and she had to stay because she was diagnosed with double pneumonia and cirrhosis.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then after that, we got an eviction notice from the landlord.
Right. So not only were you renting the old family property, you were evicted from the old family property.
Yeah.
I get it. Let's take a musical break.
What should
we play now?
How about Monk's Dream? Thelonious Monk was a big influence on me.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Franklin Crawford. So given the fact that you were asked to do what no kid could do, and you didn't do it, how have you coped with the desire to take care of your parents, the inability to do so, the guilt about it,
or the anger? Well, to tell you the truth, I had to outlive it.
So this is what you were saying before about just kind of like the law of nature. You just kind of have to let it run its course and outlive it.
Yeah. There are a lot of people that are surprised that I'm alive.
Mm-hmm. From what you've said.
Very destructive, self-destructive periods, often alcohol. I became an alcoholic at 20. I was in a hospital for it. I was already having withdrawals that were... I thought I was having a nervous breakdown like my folks, and here I'm joining them. And I was relieved to find out that, well, in fact, I had some issues, mental health issues, that would show up much later, and I'm going to get out of denial about that. I was chemically addicted to alcohol. I would, at an early age, my chemistry changed, and to get off of these binges I would go on, I'd have to spend an awful long few days
detoxing.
Because
this was not habitual drinking, this was addictive drinking.
I was a steady heavy drinker, but, you know, kind of a pothead up until I was 15, 16, but then I got, after this arrest, I got paranoid, and but I was big enough. I've been this size since I was about 14. I was about 6'3" then and 210 pounds, and I could go into bars and go to the corner store and get beer. And
nobody bothered to card you.
Not in those days, no.
And not when you're 6'3" and 200 pounds.
Yeah, so, you know, yeah, the poor store owner, when I came in, I said, hey, it's my birthday today. I'm going to get some beer. He goes, hey, how old are you? I said, I'm 18. He goes, you bitch. You've been coming here for 2-3 years, and I could have lost my license. I said, I'm sorry. I never got you in trouble.
Right.
But anyway, yeah, I mean, very serious stuff.
So what's made it possible for you to continue to function? You say you outlived your parents, but what's made it possible for you to outlive yourself?
Well, you know, I can only credit my friends and loved ones and some therapists and... it's a stubborn biological organism, and whatever smack I may have talked at the end of my binges about wanting to die or wanting to kill myself was really just despair.
Mm-hmm.
It was just me. That was, I have no more ideas. I don't
the
know.
The clarion call of despair.
Yeah, I didn't know what to do, and I did a presentation last fall for the Suicide Prevention and Crisis Service, which was the first time I came out in public specifically about mental health issues.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked about my moment when I made a deal with myself that I wasn't going to kill myself. And it was a profound moment. I mean, I had...
What did you do? How did that play out?
What was the moment?
Yeah, what was the moment? What did you do?
I moved on from the Ithaca Journal to Cornell, a very nice part-time job. Unbelievably, the salary was equivalent to what I left the Ithaca Journal at...
working a lot more hours.
For it, more than full-time. And but for whatever reasons, I was desperately depressed. I think, you know, part of it was circumstantial. The woman I was living with, we were separated. And I would get done with work, get a pack of Nat Sherman's, and back then nobody had heard of Gerolsteiner soda water, and it's a very good seltzer water, or was in its day, and over downtown Tops used to sell this stuff for a ridiculously low price. I would go in and buy like 12 cases of glass bottles of 33-ounce bottles. I would drink seltzer, because I'd say staying sober, smoke cigarettes, and watch old boxing VHS videos on TV in black and white with the sound off. And I did that for weeks and weeks. And I said, well, when were you going to do this? Because I was contemplating suicide. And I, you know, I said, time's coming. We got to get rid of this guy. And I know for some reason, you know, just a sense of survival, maybe I wasn't really, you know, I was like, I hadn't really figured out how I was going to do the thing. But I took out a bunch of pictures of myself from all different times, places, periods of my life, and I laid them out on the floor. Because I remembered some line, I said, if you're going to get to know your enemy, keep your friends close, keep your enemies closer. So you know, I know some generals would have photos of the other general in there. So I thought, take a good look at the guy. This is the guy you're going to kill. And I had kind of a conversation between myself and the executioner. And he had some questions for me. And he said, well, what's this guy's crime? I said, he's a perennial F-up. He can't get his shit together. He's just going to be like this ad infinitum. It's a waste of time, and it's better off if he just gets out of here. And the question was like, well, has he committed murder? I was like, well, no. He says, he raped, pillaged, done anything, tortured anybody, tortured animals, run a cat over with a lawnmower? I was like, you got no, I'd never run a cat over with a lawnmower. And it's got to be an intense questioning process. And finally the guy said, I'm sorry, but the guy, me.
Right. The interrogator.
The interrogator said, you know, I can't kill a guy because he's sad. And it kind of broke my heart.
Yeah.
I said, I can't kill you just because you're depressed and sad. That's not a crime. And very moving moment in my life.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean I didn't go back and do things and wind up saying similar things, but really it was off the table.
There is no sorrow like unto his sorrow.
Yeah. I mean, I looked at the pictures and I said, you're going to kill that guy. He didn't sign up for this. No. And it was the first time I think I had true empathy for myself. I just, you know, I've been very hard on myself. I'm very hard on myself.
I hear it.
Yeah. And so something opened up and I had, you know, empathy.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, he was just a child. The folks didn't mean for this to happen. They didn't, you know. And more recently, I got over another apocryphal story about my childhood that really changed my attitude a little bit. And that was my grandmother and father did not get along well. Of course, two alcoholics.
Your mother's mother and
yeah,
your
alcoholics in the same enclave are
right. Yeah.
A little too tight. But she was putting a lot of pressure on my mother when I got this from my aunt. A lot of pressure on my mom to have me aborted. Apparently this has happened before. She wanted them to get divorced.
Mm-hmm.
And to get the other two kids, my brother Douglas and my sister Roberta, out and get away from him. And my mother was really under her thumb. She was, the woman was kind of a narcissist, and it was the first time I think she stood up against her, and somebody had told her something that stuck with her and said something, a friend said, you know, a child will be a blessing to you, just don't do this. And but I took that story the wrong way.
As a judgment.
I took it as that I wasn't wanted. That I wasn't welcome here, that I was a burden, that it meant 18 more years of them having to hang together because that's what old-fashioned couples did, and that I came along and kind of ruined everything for the happy little nuclear family that was...
That never was, but...
never was one, but yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then the other day, I get, this is just in the last year, maybe, I start reflecting on it. I said, you know, your mom and her mother, it took an amazing amount of courage and ferocity to stand up to her mother and commit herself to that. I said, that is fucking love, buddy.
Yeah.
If you don't get that, you don't have ABCs down yet. And it really changed something,
yeah.
You know, it really changed it. So you were welcomed here. You were.
Yeah.
You were loved and, you know, and things, yes, things went awry, but you were raised, your first years, you were taken very, I think about parents as failures or something. I think, how much food did my mother put in front of me? I mean,
yeah.
Just,
yeah.
And as I said, things, simple things like that. She nurtured me, she, you know. I was terrified of fire sirens. I would run and hide every time I heard them. We used to have the old-fashioned ones that sound like air raid alarms.
Right.
And they would terrify me. So, but
our stories intersect in yet another way. I was born to replace a baby who died.
Mm.
My mother, who had mental illness issues after that death of that baby, went into a massive funk and was not particularly functional. And then 3 years later, she had me, and that helped to bring her out. So I bear the burden of being that joy or that hope.
You're the joy boy.
Right. But it was not real because she never saw me.
Yeah.
On some level, because she saw what she needed in terms of redemption. But her mother had died when she was 12. Her baby died when she was about the same age that her mother was when she died. And then her husband, my father, died 7 years later,
yeah.
After I was born.
A lot of loss.
What I had to do was similar. I looked at her and I saw a woman who I could get angry at and rebel from, as adolescents do, but what I saw was a woman who had suffered more than she ever would have chosen.
Mm.
And that my response wasn't to rebel against her or fight her, but was to just be kind to her.
Yeah.
So I never went through an adolescent rebellion in that way with Mom, because the need for compassion was so compelling in the way that your need for compassion for yourself when you actually saw the sadness.
Yeah, I mean, I had a lot of worries for my mom. I'd go out with my friends and I'd always call her around 10:30, 11, wherever I was, I'd get to a phone,
yeah.
And see if she was okay. And my friend's parents would always be, "You never call me when they..." Well, your mother is not under the threat of getting knocked around by my dad, but he's berserkers. And, you know, he was a good man, but he had a lot of injuries in the war, and drinking pushed him over the edge a lot of times.
Right.
A lot of violence.
So let's cut to music again. What should we play now?
Oh, just like Break It Up with some Wu-Tang Clan.
The New York Times side, staying alive was no job at second hands. Moms bounced on old man, so then we moved to Shaolin land. A young youth, you're rocking the gold tooth, low goose. Only way I begin to G-York was drug loot. And let's start it like this, son, rolling with this one and that one, pulling out gats for fun. But it was just a dream for the team who was a fiend. Started smoking wools at 16 and running up in gates and doing hits for high stakes, making my way on fire skates. No question, I was speed for cracks and weed. The combination made my eyes bleed. No question, I would flow off and try to get the dough off. Sticking up right boys on Warport. My life got no better. Same damn low sweater. Times is rough and tough like leather. Figured out I went the wrong route. So I got with a sick tight click and went all out. Catching keys from cross seas. Rolling in MPVs every week. We made 40 G's. Yo, brothers, respect mine. I ain't gonna take now. Bam, move from the gate now.
Cash rules everything around me, cream, get the money, dollar dollar bill, yo. Cash rules everything around me, cream, get the money, dollar dollar bill, yo.
It's been 22 long, hard years, I'm still struggling. Survival got me bugging, but I'm alive on arrival. I'll be back to for the streets to stay awake to the ways of the world. Deep. A man with a dream, with plans to make cream, was fail. I went to jail at the age of 15, a young buck selling drugs and such, who never had much, trying to get a clutch on what I could not touch. The court played me short and I faced incarceration, pacing, no one upstates my destination. Handcuffed in back of a bus, 40 of us, life as a shorty shouldn't be so rough. But as the world turned, I learned life was hell. Living in the world no different from a cell. Every day I skate from Jake's, giving chase, selling bass, smoking bones in the staircase. Though I don't know why I chose to smoke cess, I guess that's the time when I'm not depressed. But I'm still depressed, and I ask, what's it worth? Ready to give up, so I seek the old earth. Who explain working hard may help you maintain, to learn to overcome the heartaches and pain. You got stick-up kids, corrupt cops, and crack rocks and stray shots, all in a block that stays hot. Leave it up to me while I be living proof to kick the truth to the young black youth. When shorties running wild, smoking cess, drinking beer, and ain't trying to hear what I'm kicking in his ear. Neglected for now, but yo, it got to be accepted that what? The life is hectic.
Cash rules everything around me. Cream, get the money. Dollar, dollar bill, yo. Cash rules everything around me. Cream, get the money. Dollar, dollar bill, yo. Cash rules everything around me. Dollar, dollar bill, yo. Cash rules everything around me. Cream, get the money. Dollar, dollar bill, yo. Yeah.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Franklin Crawford. I guess what I want to say now is, while I can still feel the fireworks around some of the experiences that you've been through and the anger or the bitterness or the whatever, what I mostly feel in your presence is a sense of profound sweetness.
Well, thank you.
And how is it that you can manifest that? You know, What more than just choosing not to kill yourself?
Well, it doesn't come out of a vacuum. My parents were very sweet people. They were just very ill.
Very broken.
And they were, and for my father to have served almost heroically in the good war and come back and send his only son, let his only son go off to Vietnam because they couldn't get him into his... They just didn't do enough to protect
to get
him, give him a... Yeah, get him out of that. I mean, he had terrible eyesight. His doctor said he sees elephants and moving vans without his glasses. He was just a few shades away from legally blind. The Army didn't care. And he got a bad number in the draft. So, I have enormous... I've seen all the paperwork that my father did because my brother's dog tags did not get returned with the body. As a soldier with kind of with mental issues. PTSD, they call it nowadays, probably.
Right.
But that meant that the body was not necessarily his son's body.
Right.
This became a form fix for him and an obsession.
Right.
And understandably. Yeah. And I learned all that later.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know.
So you respect their struggle now.
Hmm?
You respect your parents' struggle now as much as you may have been hurt by it or resented it at points in the past.
Yes. Very much so. More and more as I get older. And mm-hmm. I think that's probably true for everybody.
I think that's true.
But I think, you know, there was a lot of drama and upheaval in my life in my formative years and when I had my own problems, I mean, I would stay sober for long periods of time. I'd go to AA. I'd, But I was, I relapsed. Mm-hmm. And, but when I guess it was around when I turned 60, it was like a book closed. I just heard this thud. And it was like, there, that was your adult life, Franklin. That was it. That's what happened. It's all in there. It's stories. Use it as a reference. Okay. It's not really relevant anymore in a certain kind of way. It defines who I am to a certain mm-hmm. extent, but I'm not defined by it, and I don't have to go back and hurt myself with these memories.
Right.
You know, there's a whole other side of life, psycho, spiritual, whatever you mm-hmm. want to call mm-hmm. it, life that has got a completely different take on all that. And, you know, it's just, that's my reference material.
Right. So I'm wondering, you said a number of friends and a few therapists helped you get through. Did they help you find this other side of life, or is this something you discovered more on your own?
Well, I think from when I was a little kid, I was full of horrors. I had terrible premonitions about, the end of things. One of these was caused by, there was a rock, it was a time capsule down on Main Street in my hometown. Mm. And I was not old enough yet to read, but my brother told me it was a really cool thing. So I was down there with my mother on a shopping adventure. It was one of the first times she took me with her. And I said, Mommy, read me this rock. And, it's 200 years of Bayshore history, blah, 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 historical documents, etc. To be opened in 2040. And I thought, that's so cool, I was like, well, kid, I was like, we're going to go see that, right? I had no concept of what 2040 meant, No real sense of that. And she paused, and rather than getting enthusiastic with me, she hesitated. And the thing about both my folks is they were terrible liars. They didn't like liars, and mm-hmm. they weren't good liars. And she couldn't lie. And out of nowhere, she says, honey, I can't. That's a long time from now. I don't think I'll be able to go. I said, what do you got, plans in 2040? and then she kind of laid it on me. I said, people just don't live that long.
Right.
And I just, that was the first time. I mean, I don't know why I didn't have an awareness of death. Cats died, dogs died. But they went off to happy hunting grounds.
Right.
I was 4, probably.
Yeah. So you were still really young.
Yeah. And
death is not real.
Yeah. It was something that I couldn't. And that's kind of collapsed. Yeah. On Main Street, it was embarrassing to her. It's like she had done something to her kid. And so she's, she's trying to light a cigarette and just like, hey, get up off the sidewalk. Come on.
Right.
We get scum, and we got to get up and get home. And, so I waited like a little kid. She can't go? All right. Dad, the rock, will be able to go.
Right.
It was the same thing.
Right.
I got crawled up on his lap, and I told him the story. And so I said, geez, son, by then you'll be bringing your own kids to see the mass. And I just, and I didn't even say anything. I just silently started crying and looked out the window. And that was the beginning of a period of my childhood that I spent an awful lot of time trying not to think about, that things died.
Right.
It took an awful lot of energy to put that. It would creep back in. I would fight it, and it would creep back in. So it shouldn't have shook me up so much, but it did. And I think my folks both kind of reconnoitered and said, wow, maybe we should have just pretended,
Right.
And, they didn't get it. They didn't get that I didn't have that concept at all.
Right. But what I hear in your story is children 3 and 4 and 5 years old have a capacity for sadness and sorrow that is much greater than most adults want to admit. And they could not go to that sad place with you.
And no, it scared them.
It scared them too much, and that may be part of what's behind their own issues. But you were an extremely sensitive kid for whom that sadness was profound and overwhelming. And I know a bit about what that's like. Yeah. And I've been with kids like that in those moments. And when you can go there and just be with them and not try to escape from it and not try to explain it away, but just sit with it until they're ready to move on, then it doesn't become such a lifelong burden.
Yeah.
It takes, very few adults have that presence of mind to just be there.
That's hard. Yeah. And they were having their own issues.
Yeah.
And it's okay, you know. But it marked me for a long time.
Yeah.
And you know, and then I developed a really awful condition at about 9 years of age called sleep paralysis, which I didn't know anything about. It's actually you wake up in a dream state, your body is rigid, you're awake, but you're still, but you can't move,
right.
And you're still having what are hallucinatory kind of events going on. And Susan Blackmore, a psychologist, scientist, did studies on this because she was fascinated by it because it had happened to her.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, this is like, I can't explain this.
Mm-hmm.
And she finally came up, and some other people came up with really working definition of what it was. It's not simply, you know, they used to just write it off as a subset of narcolepsy.
Right.
It's not. It's a form of paralysis. Uh-huh. But some people get caught in between dreaming and, you know, and it might have been the trauma in the house, the recent death of my grandmother on my mother's side, and, you know, you don't know.
It makes
perfect
sense.
But I remember how freaky it was, and I think I was 9 years old, I got, finally, this thing snapped, I got out of it, and I said, we can't tell anybody about this. We cannot tell anyone about this.
So
this
secret
is too weird.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so
I didn't even tell my brother, who I confided almost everything to.
And by then he was probably already, well, he was not long before
he
went to Vietnam.
He was
still home at that point.
He was senior high school.
Yeah. Let's take a break for music, and then I want to come back to the last segment. What should we play next?
Let's look here. Debussy and Ossian number 5.
Thank you.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Franklin Crawford. So Franklin, the way I end the show is really germane to the turn you made a couple of years ago. How do you take care of yourself? Emotionally, intellectually, physically, throughout the day, daily, weekly, monthly, and how do you know you need to?
Well, the fact of the matter is I do suffer from severe depression and severe anxiety and some PTSD. A very conservative Social Security disability judge in Syracuse was trying to grill me into the corner that I was an irresponsible alcoholic, and that's why I was having trouble with my job, and that's why I wasn't at work anymore, and I couldn't work. Mm-hmm. And something turned in that room. I don't know what it was, but when he turned it over to my lawyer to ask me questions, he just, after two responses, he just cut it off. He said, I'm going to cut a deal. So he saw something I didn't know about, mm-hmm. and I think it was underneath of it a lot of anger and that, you know, and a lot of deep, deep sorrow, and that I was not well. I wasn't trying to pull the wool. In a weird way, I was kind of almost hoping that he was right. You know, it's all a product of my alcoholism.
Right, and it can all go away if you can make the alcoholism
Away. Just work on that, go to meetings, work the steps, and you'll be all right. I didn't want another set of, and I've been in denial about that for a long time. But there's some medical management to my life that I don't always feel comfortable with. I have two people that I talk to officially and also professionally. Mm-hmm. I have good friends. I've been certainly with the AA program in and out for as long as I've been going. I'm no poster child for continuous sobriety, but it saved me. It helped give me time and years. All the folks from my drinking posse are pretty much dead to a person. And if they're not, it's because they stopped drinking.
Right.
And
there's a lesson there.
Yeah. And so there you have it. You know, but issues of the day now have gotten so, have pressed on me so hard that it's really challenged my balance. Especially with the pandemic, the isolation was okay. I spent a lot of time at home. Mm-hmm. I do a lot of work on Facebook. I got into photography. I had a very good show, did very well at a show at Moosewood. It was probably the last time folks were all together like that from all the phases of my life on March 1st, because that was the last really before things kicked in.
Right.
And so I felt that was good. That was a success. I remade myself. You know, the larger thing is that, yeah, I have some bad days. And, it's just, it's the niche, it's the territory. And, if I fight it, it gets worse.
Right. And if you accept it, you work within what you can do on the bad day and don't try to push.
Yeah. And I've been introduced to, I'm introduced to all kinds of approaches. Buddhism is very, I resonate to a lot of the, what's that about? And now I've always had, I would say, what they call the religious urge, a mm-hmm. spiritual urge. Mm-hmm. I had a desire to know the truth. You know, the who am I question is really profound when you sit down and, take stock of what, and I finally realized I am actually greater than, I finally understand the term greater than the sum of my parts, because I think of all my experiences, all my friends,
yes.
my family, my whole life, my cats, mm-hmm. his sweetheart, all greater than in nature. Mm-hmm. I mean, and then these profound horrors that are happening too.
Yeah. All of it is a wonder to behold.
It, you know what? It sounds corny, but it is. And when on my best moments, I can look out the window and say, wow, I just can't believe it. But that's partly privilege, on several levels.
Wow and oh my God are not that far apart.
Oh yeah.
So.
Well, I'll tell you something.
And I get a sense. And I get a sense that you know both sides.
Mm-hmm.
Franklin, it's been wonderful to get to know you.
Yeah, I'm sorry we didn't get into some of the topics that are really on me right now. The murder of George Floyd
right.
broke something old and in the way with me.
Right.
I grew up in a very mixed neighborhood.
Yeah. And I
had to examine. They asked this question. It's a primer for white people. I said, I don't need a primer for white people. I my buddies growing up with black. I had, mm-hmm. was on a black program. I was, but. And then I said, wait a second. This is not what they're asking you to do. The activists and the people that are promoting this, the better ones,
mm-hmm.
asking you to take stock of your whiteness and what that meant, whether you were born poor, you had a black sweetheart, or mm-hmm. whatever. It doesn't matter. You were born into a society. So I really had to think about this. I said, I would always, my argument is race conscious.
Mm-hmm.
And just in the past 2 weeks, after doing some serious homework, I said, I'm a racist by nature. It's not my fault. Mm-hmm. The nature of being born into a society that has perpetuated horrible oppression and crimes against black people for 400 years or more.
Right.
And, you know, my job is to talk to white people about and catch them out and confront them, not to cry to black people, I'm so sorry, I wish I could help. It doesn't work.
Right. Right.
They don't want to hear it. My friends don't want it. My black friends just take it to your white friends.
Right. As I wrote in a friend, this is not something to which we need to invite outsiders. This is an inside job, and we need to do it ourselves. In some
respect. It was a hard pill for me to swallow.
Yeah.
I mean, I said, yeah, I get it. I get what they're saying. It's and it's not self-condemnation. It's mm-hmm. about. You know,
clarity.
It's a decision. I'm going to be anti-racist because of my legacy, and that's it. So anyway, that I wanted to touch on that, but
yes,
now we're off the air. So.
No, we're not.
Okay.
So what would you like to close the show with?
Oh, let's take it out with "It Must Be a Camel" by Frank Zappa. Hot Rats, one of the albums that was very. Impressed me a lot when I was a teenager.
Again, Franklin, very, very good to get to know you.
Thank you. Thank you.